Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the growing humanitarian disaster following the superstorm that ravaged the Philippines, displacing more than 600,000 people. Joining us from the Philippines is Rosario Guzman, a research associate with the Ibon Foundation, which works for climate justice and on environmental, agricultural, and economic issues in the Philippines. We'll discuss the difficulties getting relief to those in need, and also joining us is Anne Peterman, the executive director of the Global Justice Ecology Project. She joins us to discuss the vulnerability of countries in the global south that are suffering from the consequences of global warming caused by the global north. Then we'll look into the face-off at a restaurant outside of Dallas, where a group of women and children had gathered for a meeting of Moms Demand Action for Gun Sense in America that was interrupted by a posse of men and women armed with assault rifles who belonged to an organization called Open Carry Texas. A member of Moms Demand Action for Gun Sense in America, who is afraid to give out her name, joins us to discuss how the group formed after the Sandy Hook massacre, modeled on Moms Against Drunk Driving, and how they were intimidated by the display of heavy force from heavily armed gun rights activists. Then finally, we'll speak with Catherine Kramer, the daughter of Stanley Kramer, the legendary producer-director of the Cold War classic On the Beach, and actress, comedian, writer, and producer Lily Tomlin, who are hosting the North American premiere of a new film, Fallout, that explores the mythology and reality of Neville Shute's On the Beach and its relevance today to the continuing fallout from the meltdowns at Fukushima. And joining us now from the Philippines is Rosario Guzman, a research associate with the Ibon Foundation, which works for climate justice and on environmental, agricultural, and economic issues in the Philippines. And also joining us is Anne Peterman, the executive director of the Global Justice Ecology Project. So, Rosario, my understanding is that there are about 600,000 people that have been affected by this actually being made homeless by this superstorm, which I understand is called Yolanda in the Philippines. Rosario?
There's actually, first of all, warm greetings from the Philippines. Yes.
So my understanding is that there are 600,000 people made homeless. Is that right?
The estimates vary, actually, but we can put the affected people, whether they are homeless or they are wounded or probably dead, to around 900,000 families or around 4 million individuals in 41 provinces in the Eastern Visayas region of the Philippines. Right now, we cannot tell exactly the death toll and how many are rendered homeless or are just roaming in the streets looking for food and water. But the situation is being projected is like that. People are, for instance, in one village, there are 880 families. For instance, only one family has its shelter still standing. So probably we can estimate in the 900,000 families affected as, 600,000 homeless, and more or less.
Well, the president of the Philippines, President Aquino, has said that the original death toll of 10,000 was exaggerated and it's only about 2,000. But you've told us that millions of people are affected. It sounds like what you're telling us is worse than what the president is saying.
The president has mentioned the death toll, the official count of the death toll, but we fear that many bodies are still, of course, buried in the debris or in the sand or underwater, that are still, we're still waiting for the final count. But what I'm saying is that affected people can rise to 4 million because the news, for instance, the media is just reporting one city, Tacloban City, where they find lots of bodies thrown in beaches and also in the streets. But other cities in the Eastern Visayas region are also getting trickles of reports saying that the death toll can even be higher than 2,500, the official one that the president has given to the media. So we're still waiting for the final count, but as of now, we're saying that the villages and the agricultural and the farms and other areas, if we count how many families are affected in those areas, then it would be around 900,000 families.
So let me turn to Ann Peterman, the Executive Director of Global Justice Ecology Project. And you have, of course, delegates at the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change meeting now in the UN Climate Conference in Warsaw, Poland. And the Philippines delegate there made a very passionate speech about the connection between the vulnerability of the countries in the global south that are suffering from the consequences of global warming, which is caused by the global north. Do you think that message is getting through to the international community, Anne?
Well, I think the message has gotten through, certainly, that, you know, there is an historic responsibility of the global north to the global south with regard to climate change. Now, whether that's going to be turned into action, I have a much more dubious outlook on, based on having gone to these UN climate meetings since 2004 and seen absolutely nothing accomplished. In fact, going backwards, from the Kyoto Protocol, where there was at least some kind of legally binding commitment, even if it was too small, at least it was something. Now there's nothing, and all the governments can seem to do is talk about, you know, continuing to talk about maybe one day having some kind of a commitment. And it's extremely frustrating and disgusting. And the corporate influence that's come in just the last few years has been unbelievable, to see these corporations coming in and just, you know, willy-nilly defining what the policies are going to be for these governments.
Well, of course, the UN Framework Convention on Climate Change in Warsaw, Poland, is coincidentally the World Coal Association, and coal, of course, is the greatest contributor to global warming gases. They're also having their convention there, and the head of the UN Framework Convention is giving a keynote speech to the coal producers. But let's go back to the Philippines and Rosario Guzman. The new president, of course, has promised to clean up corruption, and so far the economy has been booming, but very little, and it has a 7.8% growth rate, which is higher than China's. So there's a sort of economic miracle happening at the same time, underinvestment in infrastructure, and I imagine the huge hit from this storm is going to make the infrastructure situation so much worse. Rosario?
That's true. If we're looking at that's right. If we're looking at the impact right now of Haiyan on the Philippines, we are seeing the adaptive capacity of the country as being very low, which means that the government has not really invested in any adaptive capacity, considering that the Philippines is visited by 22 typhoons a year, four of which are super typhoons, and yet money does not go into proper infrastructure. The new government is embroiled in a very scandalous and controversial corruption issue right now. And if you're looking at how the government now responds to relief operations, it's very slow. They're saying that the aid is coming, but the aid is not where it should be going. They cannot even leave certain ports because there are no infrastructure or no transportation equipment that can deliver the aid or the relief efforts or relief assistance. So we are seeing a government that is really hiding on this economic growth, but the growth is not really where it should be going. And what is so unjust here in the current UN negotiations in the Conference of Parties is that the Tacloban City or the Eastern Visayas has very low emissions or low carbon kind of production system. It's an agricultural region, in which it suffers the worst impact of the disaster because the government has not invested in any adaptive capacity.
And what about the enormous diaspora of Filipinos? I'm calling you, Rosario, from Los Angeles, where there is a considerable population of Filipinos in the diaspora. The country's Philippines has 10 million overseas workers, already providing the Philippines with $24 billion in remittance. And a third of the people in the Philippines live in poverty, existing on $2 a day. Is the diaspora coming through for you? Are people, Filipinos abroad, stepping up?
You mean for the disaster right now?
Yes, yes. In other words, this is a catastrophe. The government doesn't have the infrastructure, hasn't invested. Sorry, go ahead. Go ahead, sorry. Rosario?
Right. Well, first of all, I would like to mention also that this new government, the Aquino government, has promised to plug that valve or whatever you call it, that leads leads to the diaspora and promise to create jobs, etc. But under the new administration, the rate of the number of deployed people has increased even. So that means unemployment has even worsened, and so Filipinos are still looking for jobs abroad. Now the ironic part is that they are hailed as heroes, and now that we have the disaster, government relief is not there, but the aid that's coming in from Filipinos abroad and even from the grassroots organizations that are based here and based abroad are the ones that are really going to those who need it. So that's the irony. We send off people, and somehow they're the ones that we can rely on if a disaster like this strikes us.
And Peterman, is there a way to link the work that you're doing on climate justice with some more efficiency, let alone justice, involved in the issues that Rosario is talking about? So if we're going to have more of these disasters, surely there has to be a better and more coordinated international response. If we're going to have all these global warming deniers say that there's nothing wrong with pumping CO2 into the air and filling up your SUV, if they want to be in denial, somebody's got to take responsibility until people wake up to the obvious connections here between climate change and these catastrophic weather events.
Well, certainly, and I think there are so many different grassroots alternatives to the top-down so-called solutions that are being offered either by the UN or by the governments and so on that are out there that aren't getting enough attention, that aren't getting enough funding, that aren't getting enough anything. I mean, those are, I think, where we really can find the positive alternatives, the positive solutions, the real future. We're not going to see the governments of the industrialized countries saying, oh, yes, we're going to pitch in billions of dollars to help our, the countries in the global south to adapt and deal with these climate disasters. You saw Rafael Correa, for example, in Ecuador saying, if we could only collect, I think it was $3 billion, we could keep the oil under the Amazon rainforest and not exploit it, not put all those carbon emissions into the atmosphere. And what governments of the world couldn't even come up with that? And that was to actually directly stop climate change from occurring. So the idea that these governments are now going to be able to come up with funding to help these countries in the global south adapt and deal with these climate catastrophes that they had no hand in causing is ridiculous. In fact, they've put the World Bank in charge of the Green Climate Fund, which is where these funds are going to come through, which means you're going to see the same kind of structural adjustment programs that we've seen from the World Bank for decades now. In other words, this climate finance that these countries need is going to be held hostage by the World Bank, saying you have to sign on to more privatization, more exploitation of your resources, more things that are absolutely detrimental to your country if you want to see any financing to help you mitigate or deal with climate change. And that is exactly what's occurring, and it's quite horrendous.
And Rosario Guzman, again in the Philippines, a research associate with the Ibon Foundation, which works for climate justice and on environmental, agricultural, and economic issues in the Philippines. If the Philippines has the lowest percentage of paved roads compared to Indonesia, Malaysia, Vietnam, Thailand, and Singapore. It also has the worst scores in other indicators such as phone lines, households with power, and electricity lost in transmission. So there is a tremendous, as we've discussed before, underinvestment in infrastructure. Is that, and that is a result, I believe, of decades of neglect and corruption. You were saying that Aquino, even though he's taking credit for economic improvement, that he is not cleaning up corruption. Is that what I heard?
Well, yes, of course. It's just unfortunate that he campaigned on anti-corruption slogan, but now the most scandalous and controversial corruption case has been unearthed, which has been going on for years, actually, since the 1920s. Which is a Port Barrel issue. But on the other hand, the decades of neglect are also effects already of embracing globalization policies. For instance, we give incentives to corporations, so foreign corporations that invest or actually just ravage our environment, like mining corporations, forestry corporations, and even fishing corporations and corporate agriculture. They just ravage the environment and leave behind nothing but traces of scandals and traces of man-made disasters. On the other hand, there is no reinvestment in any infrastructure that can make us adaptive to all these disasters that we are, all these hazards that we are facing. For instance, we also have fault lines, we have earthquakes, we are a volcanic country, and we have typhoons. So the Aquino government is now saying, oh, I'm putting in money, which is an extra, which is savings from the budget, into equipment that can detect super typhoons. But you should be doing that all along, because you are a country that is prone to typhoons. So what we're saying here now is that the unjust thing that is happening is that we are not producing global warming. We may be contributing to it, but we are not the number one contributor. And we are made to pay for the impact of climate change with our lives, with our crops, with our livelihood, and I don't know how many years it takes for us to rise again from this disaster. And yet when we are given funds for climate funding, we are made to follow certain conditionalities or even pay high interest for that. That is so unjust.
So you've made a very, very, very clear and passionate case here, which I think will both educate and disturb our audience. What can people do, though, just in terms – these obviously are huge issues that you and Anne are talking about. What can people do just immediately, Rosario, in terms of helping the situation that you are dealing with there in the Philippines?
Actually, we've heard already over the news that 22 countries have pledged aid support, and yet people are not seeing any shadow of that aid, because it has to go through the aid architecture that is both bureaucratic, that is also controlled by governments who have pledged that support. And yet the support that is really going through, all this support that's coming from ordinary people. So what we're seeing here is actually, well, again, if I may say, it's people power. It is people-to-people support. So what the Ibon Foundation has done is to set up a website or a center where people can just drop their support material and monetary, and then send it right away to our network NGOs as well, or network people's organizations that are based in Cebu, because Cebu is reachable now by through the banks or even through plane, you know, air transport. And then that NGO now will bring it in the best of its ability to Eastern Visayas. So that's what we are doing right now. We have set up a website. I enjoin people to go to our website, www.ibon.org. And there are other people's organizations that have set up relief centers, so it's sort of a people's initiative thing. instead of waiting for the government. And governments will have pledged, yes, thank you for the aid, but, you know, it's not really coming fast.
Well, I thank you so much for joining us from the Philippines, Rosario Guzman. And again, the website that you referred to is www.ebon.org. And Ebon is spelled I-B-O-N. A quick last word from you, Anne.
Well, I just want to mention that it's interesting that this typhoon hit immediately before the Warsaw Climate Conference. Last year, the middle of the climate conference was punctuated by a typhoon that hit the Philippines. The year before that, there was massive flooding that hit South Africa just before the Durban South Africa Climate Conference. So this is happening over and over and over again. And, you know, if it's not penetrating the brains of these UN delegates, then I think we need to start thinking about alternatives to the UN process, to this government process, and seeing the grassroots rising from the bottom to figure this out for ourselves.
Well, I thank both of you for joining us here today, Anne Peterman, the Executive Director of the Global Justice Ecology Project, and Rosario Guzman, a Research Associate with the Ebon Foundation in the Philippines, which works for climate justice and on environmental, agricultural, and economic issues. We're going to take a brief station break, and we'll be back talking with a member of the Moms Demand Action for Gun Sense in America, who was trying to have their first meeting, which was interrupted by a posse of heavily armed Texans belonging to the Open Carry Texas organization.
There's been a crash on the levee, and mama, you've been refused. Well, it's king for king and it's queen for queen. It's gonna be the meanest flood that anybody's ever seen. Oh, mama, you're gonna miss your best friend now. You're gonna have to find yourself.
I know my destiny. It's like the sun. You see the best of me when I have got my gun. I'm gonna get me a gun. I'm gonna get me a gun.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is a member of the Texas chapter of Moms Demand Gun Sense in America, who chooses not to be named. Welcome to Background Briefing.
Good evening.
And I understand that you're with the Dallas chapter that was actually having its first meeting of the Texas chapter. You, in other words, you had formed this group of concerned citizens in the Dallas area, and that you were having your first meeting at a restaurant, at a public restaurant in the outer suburbs. What happened? Describe to our audience what happened.
Yes, that's correct. We were having our first DFW meeting, the Dallas-Fort Worth area, to drum up membership and let interested parties know what we're doing to work towards more common sense gun legislation in our state and across the United States. And when we arrived to the restaurant and were being seated by the employees, I noticed when I looked through the windows outside of the parking lot of the restaurant that there was a group of people, mostly men, or a few women, and some small children that had begun to congregate outside in the parking lot, which was noticeable in that area. It kind of stuck out because it's not normally a place where you see loitering. It's a kind of a retail and restaurant area with some kind of upscale shops. And also, too, I had already seen images of the open carry marches and what kind of already takes place, so I kind of already knew what I was looking at. And then when some of the people who had expressed interest in coming to the meeting didn't show, I kind of put two and two together and pretty much recognized what I saw happening outside.
And you don't want to give your name out because you live in this community and you were sufficiently intimidated by this posse of heavily armed men and women with assault weapons, shotguns, and rifles.
That is correct.
That is so... To that extent, it worked. But let's just go back to the formation of Dallas-Fort Worth chapter of the Texas chapter of Moms Demand Gun Sense in America. My understanding is that that organization has modeled itself on the Moms Against Drunk Driving, right? Mothers Against Drunk Driving? That's the general idea that you've modeled your organization on since mothers intervened there and had an effect in terms of cutting down the unnecessary deaths, particularly of young people. I take it that's what's inspired you to form this organization.
Well, the organization was founded by Shannon Watts the day after the Newtown massacre, and different chapters have sprung up in different states all across the country. And those of us who are members of these chapters in our respective states and cities feel very strongly about making this country a safer place for our citizens to walk around, go out in public, and be in their homes. And we believe that there are some common sense steps that legislators can take to reduce gun violence and make us all safer. So, yes, sir.
So you're having your first meeting, and you were already a little nervous when you were looking out. And then, so what developed then as more of these people arrived? Were they brandishing their weapons when they first arrived, or because I've seen pictures of them standing as if they'd shot a bunch of deer, you know?
What happened was they congregated and greeted one another, and, you know, they were having, you know, it looked like maybe a cup of coffee, and a couple of them were having a smoke while they were just kind of waiting. And then when a good number of them got there, then I would say about 30 minutes into it, then they all strapped on their rifles. And so what they did was they pulled them out of their vehicles and then strapped them on their backs.
And then what did they do? Then sort of did they march around, or they just what?
Yes. They stood in the parking lot for a little while, kind of posturing, posing for pictures. Some of those pictures people have seen. And then they decided to go ahead and march down the street towards the football stadium that we have in Arlington, which is the Dallas Cowboys Stadium. And then they marched back up. And that is one of the things that they do. They hold marches regularly. This open carry group is very, very active in the city of Arlington, and so this is not the first time that they've had one of these marches.
So this Open Carry Texas group that have these displays of gun-toting citizens, and they do it across the state. Do the police intervene?
Well, the police are aware, and the police know that these groups are active, but what a lot of people are surprised to find out is that this is actually legal in Texas and that you can openly carry a rifle because, you know, you can't conceal it. But this is not illegal, and so they are doing it to exercise that right openly in front of everyone.
So,
and they know, and the police cannot arrest them for openly carrying long guns. It's not illegal.
What about assault rifles? And because they were carrying AK-47s and M16s,
right,
or the AR-15 version.
Anything that is considered a long gun, I do believe, sir, just falls under that description. And they don't make a distinction, from what I understand, what type of rifle it is. It's just long guns.
So,
what you cannot openly carry is a handgun.
So you can't carry a handgun, but you can carry a long
openly.
Gun. But people don't do this, do they? I mean, you don't.
No.
So
no.
So what? I'm just trying to get an understanding of their strategy there. They just want to. Do they want everybody carrying guns like them? Is that what they're saying?
Their premise is that you need that they want to do this so citizens will get used to carrying them around. So they will feel comfortable with people carrying around rifles because they believe if the American public becomes used to seeing this, then they won't be scared anymore. But, of course, most people in most areas through the entire state of Texas do not feel comfortable and are not used to seeing people carry, especially in your suburban areas like where we live, you do not see people carrying around rifles strapped to their backs. It's just not something that you that you see. And of course, it is unsettling for people to see that when they're just out and about doing their daily things. Yeah.
Well, apparently this, and again, I'm speaking with a member of the Texas chapter of Moms Demand Gun Sense in America. She chooses not to be named, and she was at the first meeting of the Dallas-Fort Worth chapter of the Texas chapter of Moms Demand Gun Sense in America. They were literally forming their first chapter and having their first meeting at a public restaurant on the outskirts of Dallas, near the Dallas Cowboys football stadium. And it looks as though, I mean, it was hardly a coincidence. How did they know that you were having this meeting, the Open Carry Texas gun toters?
Well, we put out a post on our Facebook page, our Texas page, that we were going to have a meet up in DFW, and that if they were interested in coming and, you know, seeing how they could help or how they could be a part of things, to message us, and that we would send them the location. And so we did. People that were interested, I sent them the location, and that's how they found out. We later found out that some of the members of this open carry group pretended to be interested in Moms Demand Action, but actually were just trying to find out the location to do a counter meeting or demonstration or to do their march. So
is this likely to have a chilling effect on you're trying to form this organization in a country? I mean, in a state that's fairly pro NRA. It's certainly a very conservative mm-hmm. state in terms of its politics.
Sure.
There's some talk that may change. I guess you're living in Ted Cruz land, right?
Yes, sir. That is correct. I think that even though Texas is seen as a conservative state, and it is seen as a state that strongly, protects its gun rights, Texans are also reasonable, and they want common sense gun legislation. And, how each state sees that or how their legislators deal with that, of course, is a little bit different. But Texans want to be safe. They want to feel safe in their communities. And I believe that even in a state like Texas, with the political landscape, that they, I think that overwhelmingly you could talk to the vast majority of Texans, and they will tell you that they believe that, that they want everybody to be safe and would agree to legislation to make that happen. Absolutely.
So you're trying to form your chapter there, and you're getting intimidated by these mm-hmm. guys and gals showing up
sure.
heavily armed with assault rifles. And they belong to this group called Open Carry Texas. And so just in closing, to get a sense of this Herculean task that you've taken on here of trying to, and as you've pointed out to us, your group was formed in after the Sandy Hook massacre, and it's based upon the Mothers Against Drunk Driving. So does this come down to, in terms of a national debate over so-called gun rights versus community safety, how do you think that your group of concerned mothers, and they're often referred to as soccer mums in the political parlance, do you think at the end of the day there'll be enough of you to counter the power, and particularly the political influence of the NRA and these other gun rights groups like the Open Carry Texas group that harassed you or intimidated you?
Well, we've already made some progress. It was our group that got Starbucks to change its policy about allowing guns inside of its cafes. We have seen states adopt really good common sense gun legislation throughout the country. And I do believe that we are progressing towards that. Of course, when these things happen, it reignites that debate, and it causes that national dialogue, which is so important, which has to happen. And is it going to happen all at once? No, but it's definitely something that we are working towards, and we believe it can happen with conversation and information and awareness, and really working with our elected officials and getting our citizens aware of what's actually going on, and what they can do to participate and to help.
Well, I thank you so much for joining us here today.
Sure, thank you.
And again, I've been speaking with a member of the Texas chapter, or the Dallas-Fort Worth chapter of the Texas chapter, of Moms Demand Gun Sense in America. She chose not to be named because in their first meeting, trying to form their chapter, a group of armed, heavily armed gun rights citizens showed up from Open Carry, Texas, and intimidated them on their first meeting. We're going to take a brief station break, and we'll be back joined in the studio by Catherine Kramer, the daughter of the filmmaker of the classic film On the Beach, and also Lily Tomlin will also be joining us in a moment.
But it won't be long, 'cause kids with guns, easy does it, they've got something to say.
But the Adams here, in spite of hysteria, it flourishes in Utah as well as Siberia. And whether you're a black, white, red, or brown, the question is this when you boil it down. To be or not to be, that's the question. The answer to it all ain't military datum, like who gets there firstest with the mostest atoms. No, the people of the world must decide their fate. They gotta get together or disintegrate. A whole list truth to be self-evident that all men may be cremated equal.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters. And joining me in the studio is Catherine Kramer, who is an actress, singer, journalist, and producer who founded Cat Kramer's Films That Changed the World, to showcase motion pictures that raise awareness about important social issues. And in doing so, she's following in the footsteps of her late father, the legendary producer-director Stanley Kramer, who was known for taking artistic and financial chances by making films about controversial subjects, and whose films include such classics as High Noon, On the Beach, and Guess Who's Coming to Dinner. And also joining us in a moment here is by phone is Lily Tomlin, the multi-award-winning actress, comedian, writer, and producer who has been a major force in American comedy. And she has, of course, started out in Laugh-In, and she's appeared in a number of extraordinary films such as Nashville and 9 to 5 and I Heart Huckabees. And Catherine Kramer, welcome to Background Briefing. It's good
to
see you.
Hi, I'm happy to be here. It's great.
And tell me about how you and Lily are hosting this event tomorrow. I believe it's the North American premiere of this new film, Fallout. So how did you all come together? And we'll get into the film, but give us a sense of what you're putting on here.
Well, when I first started Cat Kramer's Films That Changed the World, like you said before, I was following in my father's footsteps, which I still continue to do. And the third installment of the series was a film called Elephants and Man, A Litany of Tragedy. And as you know, Lily is very involved with animal issues and particularly elephants in captivity. And that was the subject of the film and the issues that we were focusing on. And so Lily hosted that event and was so amazing. She was on the panel. She was one of the speakers. And the next film I had after that was about bullying, LGBT bullying in schools and school violence, and Lily happened to have narrated that film, and that's called Teach Your Children Well. It's a very powerful documentary. That was the fourth installment. And again, I was so lucky to have Lily's involvement to host that and also appear and speak and join the panel. So here we are on the fifth anniversary. This is the fifth installment in my fifth anniversary of Cat Kramer's Films That Changed the World. And this film, Fallout, which is very timely. It's an Australian film, as I'm sure you know, and it's all about nuclear issues and primarily, though, about my father, Stanley Kramer, making On the Beach in Australia and taking Neville Shute's novel. And Dr. Helen Caldicott is a leading voice in nuclear issues. She's also in the film, and On the Beach is what set her on her course and her path, her life's path, her life work. And Lily is a good friend of Helen's, so this brings us all back together. I mean, Lily and I have done KPFK a couple of times here in the studio, and I'm just so honored that she's introducing Helen tomorrow night and joining the panel again. So it's really, it's so synchronistic that this is the third premiere that we've had, and having Dr. Caldicott be the keynote speaker, I couldn't be more thrilled and honored.
But so you're trying to shape these films around political themes, mm-hmm. and in a way, because one of the things I've noticed, I'm sure you have too, is how so many great documentaries are coming out now. It used to be the Academy, all the documentaries are about the Holocaust, and they're boring. But now they're taking on all kinds of political issues. And in many ways, I suspect this has a lot to do with our collective failure of journalism, because the newspapers are running, you know, they call it the dead tree business. They're running out of business. They're cutting off their and cutting back their investments in investigative journalism, et cetera, et cetera. So it seems to me that the movies, and particularly the documentary part of the movies, have really become – they filled the void in many ways. And it's not very many movies. You know, what was it, the famous adage from Samuel Goldman? If you want to send a message
– call Western Union.
Call Western Union. That was the way Hollywood was ruled, right?
It's true, because my father made movies all with a message, all social issues, and he didn't even want that title of message filmmaker. He just wanted to tell those stories and – you know, have everyone take a look at taboo subjects in our society. And that's really what these documentaries are doing today. And that is why I primarily screen documentaries. That's pretty much, except for the very first one I did, that is what I've always done and what I continue to do. And you're right, the film, you know, you can pick a certain film that has an issue or just what you want to explore an issue, and you have to find the right film for that issue. Well, there's so many powerful and enlightening documentaries, I've never had a problem finding the right film for the issue. And this happens to be, you know, unfortunate as it is, the topic that we really need to focus on just over the last couple of days with Fukushima and the talks in Iran and everything that's going on.
Right.
And this film is already released in Australia. It's gotten rave reviews. My mother, Karen Sharp Kramer, appears in it. Donna Anderson, who was in On the Beach, my father discovered her. Neville Shute's daughter, Heather Mayfield, they're all going to be on the panel tomorrow night with a lot of other experts. And so I think that we're going to have a chance to talk about the fallout, the actual fallout that we're dealing with, and also the fallout between the creative voices with the film being
right.
Neville Shute and Stanley Kramer.
Well, of course, Catherine Kramer, your father made films in an era when he really was controversial, and he was dealing in a you know, I have a millennial daughter, and the millennials are post race and post gender. I mean, they've gotten all over those hang-ups that have afflicted these previous generations. And your father was making movies during the afflicted generations, in effect.
He was the only one, I have to say, that was willing to take those chances. There may have been other filmmakers exploring the issues, but he always got the biggest stars and the greatest actors to appear in his films.
Right.
And a lot of times, you know, this is his centennial this year. He
right.
actually would have been 100. So I can't think of a better marriage with my screening series, and it's my way of contributing to a centennial. And, you know, just watching On the Beach the other night, we had a screening of it just a couple months ago. It's just the power of the film.
Talk about
a
galaxy of stars.
Yeah.
Gregory Peck, Fred Astaire, Ava Gardner. Who else?
Anthony Perkins.
Anthony Perkins.
And Donna Anderson.
Right.
Yeah.
And it was, of course, shot in Melbourne, which nowadays is actually quite an interesting city. But in those days, as Ava Gardner said, which it riled up the Australian press, this is a perfect place to make a movie about the end of the world.
That's all in Fallout, too. When you see the movie that's quoted in there.
And does the film in any way, maybe it's a digression, did it deal with Frank Sinatra showing up there on the set?
No, but I've heard
all
those
stories. But that's an hilarious
story
that He couldn't get on the set, and he came all that way in the days of before the jet aircraft, you know.
Yeah.
And he hated Australia as a result, and he never went back. And then when he finally went back, he did a press conference at the airport, and the Australian journalists are a little more aggressive than they are here. And a couple of the women journalists asked him questions which upset him. And he said something to the effect that, you know, you women are nothing but a bunch of whores or something like that. And the entire country shut down because they have powerful unions there. And nobody would put gas in Frank Sinatra's plane. Nobody would pick up his bags at the hotel. until he apologized to the women of Australia.
That's
and it
great.
Was all led by the head of the trade unions, who ended up becoming the prime minister, a guy called Bob Hawke. So it was the only time that Frank Sinatra in his life actually had to apologize, because, you know, his whole idea was, I did it my way, you know. So there's a that's a little bit of a tangent. But so tell me about why, you know, I remember from the film, one of the most, just from somebody that's interested in filmmaking itself, one of the more extraordinary scenes that I remember is towards the end of the movie, is when Gregory Peck is the commander of the submarine, surfaces in San Francisco Bay, and the entire city is dead because everybody on continental America has died. And the premise of the movie is that Melbourne, Australia is the last piece of on the planet where people can still live before the fallout gets them.
Yeah, that was also, you know, in the book as well, I believe. And every time that I see it or anyone sees it, they just fall silent. And, you know, the slogan at the end, or the lament at the end, there is still time, brother. When you look at that now, you think, you know, we really haven't learned that much. And that's the whole focus of my screening series is, yes, my father's films changed laws. And yes, a lot of the films that I'm screening now, or that are out there today, the documentaries especially, have changed things, made changes, and have changed laws too. But every so many years, a new generation forgets that and they have to be reminded again. You know, it's just like with the Holocaust. I was at a function the other night and they were telling us that anti-Semitism is on the rise again in Europe. And, you know, when you think that my father made Judgment at Nuremberg, that just that movie alone, and then, you know, Spielberg made Schindler's List, you look at films like that and just educating, you know, new generations about the Holocaust, to think that it would be starting up again, because unless we remind everybody all the time, they'll just keep going back to their old ways. And we have Rick O'Berry coming, you know, tomorrow night, who is the subject of the film The Cove.
The Cove, I remember. I interviewed him, yeah.
And I screened that. Film, I screened that for the series, and that was one of the best ones I did, because I invited Academy members who had not seen the film. They were afraid to look at the dolphin slaughter. And when they saw the film, you know, they went and voted for it, I have to say, that night. I couldn't believe they were afraid to see it. It was the hot film that everyone was talking about. We had a 5-year-old activist, and he said, if I can see it, the adults can see it. But he is going back to Tai Chi. They're still slaughtering the dolphins. You know, it stopped for a while but after the movie won the Academy Award, but they're starting up again. The minute that they think that people have forgotten, they'll go back. So, but I can't think of an issue bigger than the end of the world. Can you?
Well, it hasn't happened, but it sure felt like it was going to happen for many decades. Yeah. And I suppose in a converse way, you can argue that the fact that the Cold War ended, and even though the weapons are still there, there's been psychological disarmament. There may not be physical disarmament, but it's highly unlikely that any of the nuclear states, except perhaps Pakistan and India, will use their weapons. They'd still have them, and so there's a lot of work to do in terms of disarmament. There's no two ways about it. But the fact that this, what seemed so intractable, that seemed so inevitable, particularly during the Reagan administration when I worked on the nuclear freeze and other issues, it did seem like that it was going to happen eventually. And I worked at Los Alamos, as a matter of fact, on a project on the future of deterrence, because at some point or other, Murphy's Law comes into play, you know, and you kept building more weapons. And the more weapons you built on both sides, the less secure you became. So they were trapped. And that whole Gordian knot was broken by Reagan and Gorbachev. So the fact that we as a species can actually change, I think, is also hopeful. And you know, also it's also worth mentioning that we as a species also are capable of creating these monstrous weapons and letting them get out of control. And your father made that movie when things couldn't have been more bleak, right? That was before – was that before the Cuba crisis?
Well, 1959.
Yes, it was.
It was three
years before the Cuba crisis. And that was at the height of paranoia about the Russians are coming.
And that was also Fred Astaire making his dramatic debut. You know, I mean, people – you know, he had to cast – actors that the audience that the audience could relate to because the subjects were so bleak and people didn't really want to face these issues. So by having Ava Gardner or Gregory Peck, they could relate better to what the characters were going through.
Right.
So if anyone ever criticized him, you know, why didn't he use up-and-comers? He did with Donna Anderson in her role, but he had to have, you know, first of all, to get the film made that still exists today, you had to have pretty big stars just to get the movie made. But, you know, he was very specific about who he wanted. And you'll see in Fallout, it goes through the background of all that.
Right. But if he made that film in 59, it came out in 59, in other words, that was the end of Eisenhower. Kennedy hadn't even come in. And Kennedy, of course, I mean, Eisenhower tried to end the Cold War, and he almost had a deal on the table with Khrushchev, who visited here. Remember, he wanted to go to Disneyland, right? And that was all torpedoed by the U-2 incident.
I think some of that's touched on, you know,
in which
you have to see the film.
I have to see the film, of course.
I really want you to see it.
I do.
You'll come tomorrow.
I will. But I know from my research on the Eisenhower administration how close they came to a deal. And then the U-2 thing blew that out of the water. So I'm trying to get a sense of where the public was at when that film came out, your father's film came out. It was before Kennedy, and Kennedy there was a sense of a breath of fresh air. And no sooner had he got into office than there was the Bay of Pigs, and then there was the Cuba crisis. And then he made that extraordinary speech at American University.
Well, I found out my father's on the beach helped start the disarmament talks at the UN. You knew about that, right?
No, I was about to suggest that he was, you know, making this film in an environment, you know, that was pretty bleak. So tell us about how that happened and how much he influenced the environment.
Well, I know a little bit about it, but tomorrow night, the experts on that subject would probably be my mother and Donna Anderson.
Mm-hmm.
And they're going to definitely be touching upon that. But I do know that got, you know, the UN to start the disarmament talks, and he premiered it, you know, in many different countries in one night. I think that was the first of its kind to happen like that.
Mm-hmm.
And that's all in Fallout. The interesting thing about this film is that it doesn't just touch on the bomb and the origins of it. And, you know, it spends a lot of time on the history of that, sure, in the beginning. And it paints the picture of what we're dealing with now. So it brings it up to date and with everybody's voice, like Helen and Gideon Haig, who's interviewed in there. There's, you know, you'll see it. And Philip Davey, who did When Hollywood Came to Melbourne, he wrote the book about it.
Mm-hmm.
But it spends a lot of time on just Neville Shute himself moving to Australia from Great Britain and writing on the beach, and then, you know, the battles he had with my father on how the movie should be made. And a great deal of the last half of the film focuses on that. So it really gives audiences a chance to focus on not only the issues and see, you know, we were dealing with it back then, we're still dealing with it now, but it's also a slice of film history and the classic sense. So that's what's so great about it.
Well, tell me, though, there's a euphemism here in Hollywood called creative differences. So tell me about the creative differences that the novelist Neville Shute, who did A Town Like Alice and some classic books, many of which were made into movies. What was the fights that he had with your father
well,
over on the
beach?
Well,
that's all documented in the film. I know he did.
But just give us a tiny taste of what was the...
He disagreed so much with, you know, the love story part of it. And I think in the book that was not touched upon at all.
Well, if the world's going to end, what are you supposed to do?
He wanted to stick just to the book, which was bone-chilling when...
Right.
You know, I mean, that's even what Helen said when she first read it. And then seeing the film, that has more humanity by not having it stick exactly to the book. You have to have romance and love if the world is ending. You know,
it's, sure.
That's what you would do is grab onto somebody, right?
Right.
That's what I think the main fight was between them was about them consummating their love affair, you know, having a love affair and actually you know, having that be a big part of the story. But nobody could relate to it otherwise, especially not in 1959.
Right.
But I don't know if a filmmaker and a writer or one of the directors and the writers, the novelists, they always argue. I mean, it's rare to find a meeting of the minds there.
So. Well, writers are particularly protective of their babies, you know. But in this case, it feels like, from what you've told me, that your father made the right call in the sense that it connected the idea that these are the last people on the planet, you know, and death is encroaching.
And the use of Waltzing Matilda in there really, you know, that's just so haunting.
Yes.
Some of the scenes where that song I can never forget those images, and what the music just stays with you. And I think it really makes you feel that you're there too, and that, you know, it's the end of time, and it just seems contemporary to me.
So this, what's going to happen with this film that you're premiering tomorrow then, Fallout? It's a documentary film, right?
Yes.
About the making of your father's film and its political impact. But it also, doesn't it have echoes of what's happening today with Fukushima? We don't even know what the fallout from Fukushima is and where it is and how much it's happening. And we know it's affecting the West Coast here in the United States.
Well, there was a special the other night on ABC where they said, you know, be careful that it's coming here. We may have to evacuate. I was with some people the other night that think that it's already here on the West Coast. And they're selling their home in Santa Barbara. They say a lot of people are selling their homes in Malibu, I guess because they think of...
Really?
I think it's... Some people think that we've been lied to and that it's already here. So it's a bleak thought, but it's on everybody's minds for sure.
Well, you know, I talked to some people that were dealing with the sailors who were affected on the USS Ronald Reagan and big nuclear aircraft carrier. And believe it or not, the U.S. Navy, in a relief effort, parked that big boat right next to the Fukushima within days of the accident. And it has to desalinate its water through its nuclear reactors. So it's sucking in all this seawater that's contaminated by radiation, and all the sailors on that ship were showering and drinking that water. And then it was the sailor who had to take the flag from the top of the mast every day as they change the flags or whatever they do in the ritual. And there was so much radiation on that flag that he set off the Geiger counters. And then but the idea that the U.S. Navy sent a ship in there and these brain dead officers weren't thinking about all of that, you know, radioactive water that was, because what they had to do was they had to pump seawater to keep the cores cool, or, you know, they were melting down, literally melting down. They had to keep throwing all this water on them to cool them, and all that water went back into the ocean. So, I mean, it's a horrible story. So I don't believe that we know a fraction of what the consequences of Fukushima are.
No, I don't think we do either.
Well, we have to see Fallout, right?
Yes, you better come see it.
I'm under orders here. Okay, we have to wrap up now. I thank you so much, Catherine Kramer, for joining us here. I appreciate it.
Thank you so much.
And Lily, who didn't show, but that's show business.
She was calling. Did she? Okay.
Well. No, whatever. And again, I've been speaking with Catherine Kramer, actress, singer, journalist, and producer who founded Cat Kramer's Films That Changed the World. Tomorrow, they are showcasing the North American premiere of a new documentary feature, Fallout. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. You can also contact me. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.